take the matter under submission.
Thank you, Chief Judge Garland. My name is Stephen Goldblatt. I'm a professor at Georgetown University Law Center, and I was appointed by the court in this matter to be an amicus curiae in support of the appellant, Mr. Davis. With court's permission, Robert S. Silverblatt, a third-year law student at Georgetown, will present argument today.
Welcome to approach the podium.
May it please the court. I'd like to begin with the question of whether a panel can revisit the probabilistic impact test from Rizzoli. In Rizzoli, this court determined that it could apply a probabilistic impact test to federal prisoners because nothing in the Prysor trilogy prevented it from doing so. In particular, the court premised the application of the probabilistic impact test on the fact that, and here I'm quoting, none of the claims in the trilogy addressed claims with a merely probabilistic impact on the duration of custody. Thus, none had occasion to rule definitely on whether such claims need be brought in habeas. 5 years later, however, in Wilkinson v. Dotson, the Supreme Court did address such a claim, parole eligibility, which is the exact type of relief that was at issue in Rizzoli, and it did rule definitively on that issue and held that it must be allowed to proceed outside of habeas.
But it didn't go to federal prisoners, right? So we're still left at the Supreme Court level, however, with that distinction. So what do we do with that?
That is correct, Your Honor.
But aren't we supposed to wait to get direction? We don't lead out on these things, or shouldn't.
We don't believe it's necessary in this case, Your Honor. This court has always operated with the background assumption that the Prysor trilogy does in fact apply to federal prisoners. That was the holding of Williams v. Hill, in which this court applied Heck to federal prisoners. And in Rizzoli itself, the court noted that in Chapman Bay, the court recognized the arguable distinction from Prysor, which is that the case involved a federal prisoner, but ruled that that was not a relevant consideration. And as this court recognized in Natural Resources Defense Council v. Nuclear Regulatory Commission, the fact that there's a factual difference between a Supreme Court decision and a panel decision does not prevent a panel of this court from concluding
right. But in Rizzoli, the court listed four reasons. You've very well attacked the first, which was the uncertainty about the Prysor trilogy, but the fourth reason was Chapman Bay made clear that a major implication of habeas exclusivity was its impact on venue, because a plaintiff could always name a defendant in the District of Columbia. Now, that wasn't addressed in Dotson at all.
That's correct, Your Honor, but two responses there. The first is that this court in Rizzoli never suggested that the venue concern alone could justify the probabilistic impact test. As this court noted in Starnes v. McGuire when considering whether to transfer a case, court congestion alone can never justify transfer. But beyond that, the venue concern was premised on the fact that such claims are proper in habeas in the first instance. The probabilistic impact test has always rested on the assumption that even if such claims aren't to be brought exclusively in habeas, they are at the very least proper in habeas. But the Supreme Court's decision in Skinner v. Schweitzer seriously called that into question. In Skinner, the court quoted from Justice Scalia's concurring opinion in Dotson and said that the Supreme Court has never recognized habeas as even available when the claim would, quote, neither terminate custody, accelerate the future date of release, nor reduce the level of custody. And it noted that such claims may be brought, quote, if at all, unquote, only outside of habeas. So we think that there is a serious risk that the probabilistic impact test is funneling to habeas claims that cannot even be heard there. And Mr. Davis's case is an example of that, because relying on Chapman Bay, he proceeded in 2241. The court told him that he could not proceed there, told him to proceed in 2255, But it is our reading of the Fifth Circuit case law, and the Fifth Circuit is where a sentencing court is located, that if you were to bring a 2255 motion there, the court would have to dismiss for lack of subject matter jurisdiction because his claim is not proper in habeas. What Dotson focuses the inquiry on is claims that are and are not at the core of habeas corpus, with the core being defined as claims that, if successful, would necessarily demonstrate the invalidity of confinement or its duration. And we see no reason to draw a distinction in that respect between state and federal prisoners. In fact, as far back as 1974, the Supreme Court in Davis v. United States recognized that 28 U.S.C. 2255 was put in place to create relief that was identical in scope to the relief that was available to state prisoners under 28 U.S.C. 2254. So when we're looking at what is at the core of 28 U.S.C. 2255 versus 2254, we don't think that you can draw the distinction between state and federal prisoners. And in fact, this court has in the past looked to cases involving state prisoners when deciding what the proper scope is for federal habeas involving federal prisoners.
Mr. Silverblatt, this takes me back, what you're saying right now, to your point earlier that a small or mere factual distinction should not control our reading of the Supreme Court's decision. I'm not certain, but I thought that in Dotson, the Supreme Court specifically reserved the question of application to federal prisoners. Is that wrong?
The Supreme Court didn't address that question. Justice Scalia did in his concurring opinion, which he believed was expanding on and just explaining the reasoning.
He assumed it would apply to federal prisoners.
He did, Your Honor.
His view, that would be bad if it went the other way.
And what did the court say that bears upon this?
Excuse me?
What did the court say that bears upon its application to federal prisoners?
What the court said is it focused the inquiry on the core of habeas corpus. And we don't think that that core is any different for state prisoners than it is for federal prisoners.
I understand that, but I want to know what the court said specifically that bears on, beyond what you've just recounted. They kept talking about his being a state, referring to the petitioner there as a state prisoner.
That is correct, Your Honor, but that was also the case in the Prisor Trilogy, and this court has operated under the assumption in the past that the Prisor Trilogy does, in fact, apply to federal prisoners. In Chapman Bay, which involved a federal prisoner, the court said it was reaching its conclusion, quote, within the meaning of Prisor. And in Rizzoli itself, the court noted that the arguable distinction that Chapman Bay was a federal prisoner was something that did not concern the court in Chapman Bay. Moreover, in Williams v.
Perhaps
Hill,
it was in response to Justice Scalia's separate opinion, but the court, without saying, I guess, specifically they're reserving the question of as to federal prisoners, just refers time and time again to the petitioner there as a state prisoner, refers to prior cases as being arising from state prisoners' claims.
That is correct, Your Honor. But in Rizzoli, this court didn't say that it was waiting for a Supreme Court decision that involved federal prisoners. What it specifically said was that it was waiting for a Supreme Court decision that involved a claim like that at issue in Rizzoli, which was a claim with a merely probabilistic impact on the duration of custody. That's precisely what the court addressed in Dotson. And we think in doing so, it overruled Rizzoli. To the extent that this court has concerns about the relationship between Rizzoli and Dotson, we would suggest that this would be a case where the court could use an irons footnote to get the endorsement of the en banc court.
Now you're counting on everybody unanimously agreeing, right? That's what an irons footnote requires.
We think that there's three, but all of the judges.
Yes.
Yes, Your Honor. We do think that there is enough in Dotson without an irons footnote to let this panel conclude that the Rizzoli probabilistic impact test is no longer good law, and particularly when you look at Dotson and Skinner together, we think that together those cases.
And Skinner, are you relying just on the phrase "if any"? Is that the whole argument there?
No, Your Honor. It's also that the court quoted Justice Scalia's concurrence in Dotson and said that the Supreme Court has never recognized habeas as even available where success would, quote, neither terminate custody, accelerate the future date of release, nor reduce the level of custody. That's on page 1299 of Skinner. And we think it's important to note that they were quoting Justice Scalia, who was using that language for a very particular purpose, which was to say that such claims absolutely cannot be brought in habeas. And it's the experience of the Court of Appeals, we think, that in other circuits, these claims are being rejected if brought in habeas. And if Mr. Davis were to proceed under 2255, the Fifth Circuit case law would suggest that he would not be allowed to bring it because he is not challenging the validity of his sentence.
What did you say about Skinner a moment ago?
Skinner calls into question, Your Honor, the premise that such claims are proper in habeas. This court specifically in Rizzoli justified the probabilistic impact test because such claims, even if they do not need to be brought exclusively in habeas, at the very least can be brought in habeas. In other words, this court would be channeling claims to jurisdictions that would be able to hear them. But
and
Skinner calls...
What do you suggest is the role of Lacey Davis in all this?
In Lacey Davis, two members of the panel suggested that the Supreme Court would need to say explicitly that the Prisor Trilogy and Dotson apply to federal prisoners. We don't believe that to be the case, particularly because this court has always assumed that the Prisor Trilogy applies to federal prisoners, and Dotson clarified the meaning of the Prisor Trilogy.
So we should just say Lacey Davis was we were mistaken in Lacey Davis?
We do believe that Lacey Davis was wrongly decided, Your Honor, but this court need not conclude that necessarily in order to rule in our favor, particularly in light of Skinner v. Schweitzer, which postdates Lacey Davis. That was in 2011.
I thought your argument with respect to Lacey Davis is that it's an unpublished opinion, and therefore, although precedential, not binding.
That is also correct, Your Honor. But particularly in light of Skinner v. Schweitzer, we think that this court should take the opportunity.
Wasn't Skinner a state prisoner?
Yes.
Yes, but this court has in the past looked to state prisoner cases to define the scope of what is proper under habeas. That's what happened in Chapman Bay and Rizzoli when this court cited to the Supreme Court's decision in Braden. And under the Supreme Court's current understanding, we believe that these claims would not be proper in habeas.
If this case were remitted to, or this petitioner were remitted, appellant, to habeas and hence to the Fifth Circuit?
Yes, Your Honor.
You're saying his case would not be heard, would be deemed not cognizable in habeas in the Fifth Circuit?
That is our understanding. There's a Fifth Circuit case, United States v. Cooley, which held that a motion under 18 U.S.C. 3582 is not a collateral attack within the meaning of 2255. And that is exactly
that
what he was
ruling
trying to
then bring. Provide a vehicle for the clarification that you're seeking?
No, Your Honor, because in a 3582 motion, the court is of limited jurisdiction and would not be able to decide Mr. Davis's equal protection claim or the Rizzoli channeling issue. But we do think that the fact that the Fifth Circuit case law does suggest that it's not cognizable in habeas is a reason why this court should be skeptical of funneling it to habeas in the first instance. If there are no further questions, I'll reserve.
Yeah, I do. So why are there no other circuit opinions on this issue? Are there no other circuits' opinion? Maybe I should start with that. None are cited in either party's briefs.
That's correct, Your Honor. As far as we are aware, the D.C. Circuit is the only circuit that distinguishes between state and federal prisoners. Other circuits have cited to Wilkinson v. Dotson in cases involving federal prisoners. For example, there's the Seventh Circuit case of Glaus v. Anderson, which is cited in our briefs. It's not that any other circuits are holding that the Prisor Trilogy does not apply to federal prisoners. It's just that they're not drawing the distinction between
them. Are there other circuits in which, if it's not necessarily so, they reject it in a federal case?
There are other circuits that have held under Dotson if it does not necessarily implicate the validity or duration, then it cannot be brought in habeas.
Which circuits are those?
The 11th Circuit, for instance, in the case of Hutcherson v. Riley, the citation there is 468 F3rd 750. It's a 2006 case from the 11th Circuit, which held that 1983 and habeas are mutually exclusive avenues, which seems to be the suggestion of the Supreme Court in Skinner v. Schweitzer.
Wait, 1983, but that, again, I'm asking about federal cases for federal prisoners?
None of the cases specifically hold that it's mutually exclusive in the context of federal prisoners, but we have no reason to believe that these circuits are differentiating between state and federal prisoners.
But so there's never been another federal case which has rejected a Bivens claim on the same in this for the same reason that the district court in this case did, or accepted a Bivens claim like that?
We are not aware, Your Honor, of any other circuits that have rejected a Bivens claim on the ground that would have a merely probabilistic impact on the duration of custody.
And any that have accepted one?
We are not aware of any that have accepted either.
Seems, I don't doubt you because we look too, but it seems odd. The federal prisoners seek relief all the time, so you would think that at least one of them would cross this particular line and some other circuit would have the case since we have so many of them.
In the case of Williams v. Hill, the court addressed Bivens in the context of a federal prisoner. That's a D.C. Circuit case, and it said that the Prisor Trilogy was not based on any comedy concerns. It wasn't based on anything particular to 1983, and in fact would apply with equal force to cases brought under Bivens. So there is, at the very least, a suggestion in this circuit that the Prisor Trilogy applies with equal force to federal prisoners bringing Bivens claims.
Okay. Any other questions?
Yeah, I think so. What about the Seventh Circuit case, Robinson against Sherrod, saying, now that was a state prisoner, saying, when there isn't even an indirect effect on duration of punishment, as in Dokken, we will adhere to our longstanding view that habeas is not a permissible route for challenging prison conditions. Wouldn't that apply by seemingly to federal prisoners as well?
Yes, Your Honor, we believe it would, and it would suggest that habeas is unavailable in claims that are outside the core of habeas, which is, we believe, one reason why this court should reevaluate the probabilistic impact test.
Are you saying it puts the Seventh Circuit in the Fifth Circuit's corner on this?
We what we're saying is that the prisoners who would be funneled into habeas under the probabilistic impact test will in all likelihood not be able to bring their claims in habeas.
Then there's the Sixth Circuit case, right, which says, let's see, that dealt with a federal prisoner parole eligibility claim, right? And the court said that could be heard either in habeas or in some 1983 equivalent.
There is some tension, Your Honor, in the circuits as to whether habeas and 1983 are mutually exclusive. We think that the suggestion from the Supreme Court in Skinner v. Schweitzer is that they are, and we believe that that will be the direction in which circuit courts will be going, especially in light of Skinner. It is the opinion of the 11th Circuit in the Hutcherson v. Riley case as well.
This is not a jurisdictional question, but a 12b-6 question, why should we not just look on the face and see that he has a merits argument about equal protection that's really impossible for him to establish?
First, Your Honor, this court has always treated it, at the very least, as a threshold issue, and we are unaware of any cases in which the court has overlooked the habeas channeling and reached directly to the merits. And there are, in fact, cases where the court has suggested that it is jurisdictional.
It's obviously not jurisdictional. The Supreme Court said it was waived in one case. You can't waive a, and we said in Chatham Bay it was waived.
That was the Heck bar, Your Honor, and the Supreme Court held that a particular factual.
What about in Chatham Bay? Didn't we say it was waived because the government didn't press it?
Once the court made the determination that it belonged in 2241, which implicates personal jurisdiction, the court held that it was waived. But that doesn't go to the first order question of whether it belongs in habeas or not in habeas. The court decided that it belonged in habeas, and once it decided, 2241 concluded it was waivable.
Given the Supreme Court's recent jurisprudence about jurisdictional provisions, which basically say it has to say it's jurisdictional, it has to be in a section entitled jurisdiction or something like this, why would we regard this as really a judge-made interpretation of an implicit exception to 1983, which is what the court says in Dotson? Why would we regard that as jurisdictional? Judges can't decide something's jurisdictional.
Your Honor, the district court below seemed to view it as jurisdictional, and we would also note that...
Well, that, of course, does not bind us.
Sure, of course. And we would also note that the Supreme Court case that noted the waiver was in the context of the HEC bar, and in cases involving HEC, the question isn't habeas versus non-habeas. There's the assumption that the relief sought cannot proceed in habeas. So the question there is essentially, is there an extra element to the 1983 claim, which is that something's been invalidated? So it's a little bit different.
If let's say we were to lose on that point and we thought it was not jurisdictional, is there any theory under which an equal protection claim for a non-fundamental right, non-suspect class, where the only argument is that big drug dealers are dealt more harshly than small drug dealers, could be unconstitutional on an equal protection ground?
Your Honor, we believe that that is something that the district court should look at on remand.
I got that part, but can you think of any argument? Can you even think of an argument under which somebody could win that case?
We think it's important to note here that Mr. Davis was sentenced under a regime in which 1 gram of crack cocaine was treated as the same as 100 grams of powder.
That's not his challenge.
That is correct.
Right? His challenge is big dealers are not getting the mitigation on that of the difference between those two that small dealers got, not that that it violated equal protection to have a distinction between crack and powder. Right?
That is correct, Your Honor. But what he is challenging is his exclusion from an ameliorative benefit that was meant to rectify a situation that all parties have agreed led to gross injustices. And the specific
claim... All parties didn't agree that it, and particularly Congress apparently didn't agree that it led to a gross injustice for large dealers. It's clear in both from Congress and from the Sentencing Commission that they were not sympathetic to large dealers in that regard.
And they may not have been, Your Honor, but the specific question of whether the 18-to-1 ratio is constitutional is a question of first impression in the circuit. And the commission, in explaining why this court should take it up in the first instance, has relied on an affirmative defense of qualified immunity. It has relied on out-of-circuit case law and information not even in the record. So we think that all of these things together counsel in favor of letting Mr. Davis have the normal benefit of the procedure in the district court and to allow him, if need be, leave to amend so that he can reframe his claim.
Isn't the question whether the normal benefit of the procedure in the district court extends to completely frivolous claims?
Your Honor, whereas is the case here, the district court dismisses under the patently insubstantial doctrine. This court typically remands without even considering the merits in the first instance or even screening them. And there's been no suggestion here that Mr. Davis's claim is frivolous from the commission. In Best v. Kelly and in Ord v. District of Columbia, both involving the patently insubstantial doctrine, this court noted that it's possible that the claims may fail to state a claim.
I'm referring to the equal protection argument. As Chief Judge Garland has I think, demonstrated, there's no basis for an equal protection challenge here. At least you haven't been able to identify one. There may be a basis for an equal protection challenge of the 18-to-1 or the 100-to-1 distribution, but that's not what we have before us now. Your client's claim is that he should have gotten the benefit that smaller dealers got. And what is the possible basis for Congress not being able to make that distinction? And if you can't identify that basis, then what don't we have before us a merits claim that is completely insubstantial? And then doesn't that raise a jurisdictional question for us?
Mr. Davis, Your Honor, has alleged that his exclusion and the lines drawn by the commission lack a rational basis. That is an argument that has not been explored and we think has been inadequately briefed. And it may be that Mr. Davis ultimately fails on his merits claim, but it's certainly not in the sense that would rob this court of jurisdiction. As this court noted in Best v. Kelly, the claims that rob the court of jurisdiction are those that are essentially fictitious as a factual matter. And that's not what we have before us today.
But that again goes on the assumption we need to regard this as a jurisdictional matter, right? Because that theory, those cases are all about so ridiculous as to be non-jurisdictional. But the statute itself, 1915AB1, authorizes the district court to dismiss under 12B6 without even hearing from the defendant, right?
Yes, and in Rizzoli, this court recognized that ability, but still remanded for leave to amend so that the litigant there could have a full opportunity to proceed in front of
him. Well, he had a better argument in Rizzoli than there is. At least there was a colorable argument in Rizzoli based on facts. There's no fact issue, really, with respect to this case. This is purely a legal question about whether it violates the Equal Protection Clause.
Yes, Your Honor, but even where this court has been profoundly skeptical of a claim, it has remanded to the district court, for instance, in Anyanwutaku, where it described the complaint as very confusing and recognized that it would be possibly subject to dismissal below. We are only asking the court to allow Mr. Davis to proceed and have the opportunity to bring his claim.
This case was dismissed without prejudice, was it not?
It was, Your Honor.
So what's been our practice with regard to remanding such a case as opposed to dismissing it, which is no bar to a better filing?
Well, at the very least, we would urge this court to vacate the part of the opinion that suggests they would have to bring it in 2255, because otherwise he would not be free to refile it in the District of Columbia. We'd have to go to Texas. As to the specific remand question, this court extended the leave to amend principle to cases dismissed without prejudice in an unpublished decision in Plummer, but there are no published decisions that suggest that the deal with the interplay between the Rizzoli rule for dismissals with prejudice and dismissals without prejudice.
Okay, thank you very much. Hear from the other side.
Good morning. May it please the Court. Alan Birch on behalf of the United States and the Sentencing Commission. There are four points I'd like to touch on briefly. The first deals with your question, Chief Judge Garland, about the uniqueness of D.C. D.C. does not have any federal prisons, and so the venue concern that permeates many of these cases is unique to D.C. in that regard. Many prisoners do come here, and I think the channeling rule has a special need here, and there is a special need for that here in D.C. to make sure that prisoner cases are not here when they should be somewhere else.
Well, they should be is the question, right? We can't just do it because we don't want to hear the cases and we want another court to hear them.
No, but that's exactly right. And the channeling rule is
some other candidates.
Yeah, that's exactly.
Sorry,
there are other agency cases we'd prefer.
Certainly. That's exactly right. But I think that's why none of the other circuits have picked up on this to the same extent that this circuit has had to deal with it. And the other circuits, you know, I haven't found any that have explicitly rejected the Rizzoli Chapman Bay probabilistic impact test. Most of the all of the cases I have found simply apply the Heck, Dotson, Prizer state standard. And the cases that I read would have come out the same way. So I don't under either standard. So I think that the D.C. is unique that way, and I think that's why we have this issue here. The second point I wanted to make is to keep in mind about
But Dotson seems to clearly indicate, I mean, it's at least we can predict a trajectory, right, that this distinction between federal and state prisoning is collapsing, right? And hear me out and see your response.
Sure.
If I'm right about that, it's collapsing. Your argument would be yet there's something distinct about the D.C. Circuit that
that's just the first point is really a descriptive point, Your Honor. It doesn't relate directly to the logic of the legal merits. It's just a description.
Why we couldn't find any cases.
Right. Why is
it
odd? And that's why it's odd.
Okay.
The second point is that the channeling rule, as for lack of a better term, does not simply put everything into habeas. What it does is it puts it into the criminal side of the judicial system. Be that habeas, be that direct review, be that even a 3582 motion, which is certainly part of the criminal proceedings within the federal judicial system. Mr. Davis himself has brought several of these, three of, that I'm aware of these 3582 motions asking for a modified sentence. There is no barrier that I'm aware of to him bringing a constitutional challenge through that vehicle. Indeed, the three that he brought involved constitutional challenges. They weren't equal protection challenges. They were Apprendi, Booker-type challenges. And you will find in every circuit, including the Fifth Circuit, examples, well, I shouldn't say every circuit, the circuits that I looked at, you will find examples of district courts and appellate courts entertaining constitutional challenges through this vehicle. Now, the Fifth Circuit has even heard an equal protection challenge. Most of them do tend to be separation
of powers. In the context of a habeas case or?
No, in a 3582 C2 challenge. So the channeling rule needs to be put in context of what it's channeling and what it's doing. That brings me to my third point, which is the purpose of it. And I think this goes to your concern.
I'm a little confused, I have to say. So we would be holding your, if we held your way, that this has to be brought in habeas, right?
Not necessarily, but that it has to be brought on the criminal side of the system. That's what the that's
just
what
couldn't
the general,
be brought in 1983 or well,
right. It can't be brought in 1983. It can't be brought in Bivens until or unless he succeeds in on the criminal side.
Is that what we said in Rizzoli? Succeeds on the criminal side or succeeds in habeas?
There is language in the various cases that suggest the D.C. Circuit cases that suggest. That it's not just habeas, that it's direct review.
Which line? Oh, well, or direct review, yes, but we'll ask that, obviously.
There was one case, I think it may have been.
But none of the ones in our line here, Rizzoli or Wutaku or Chapman Bay, none of them talk about that, do they?
There is one case that talks about other. Aspects of the criminal system, but in any event, you may need to clarify that that's possible because this brings me to my third point. Really, like maybe
well, that clarified. Yeah, we've never made the point before. It's not being clarified. Is it?
Well, yeah. Well,
in order to save Rizzoli, we have to make a whole new law on another topic. Is what you're saying?
No, I think you have to. What you do is
you're saying we have to recast this,
the rule. Right? Recast the rule, perhaps as.
I think it's very clever. It just worries me that no one's ever thought of this before. I mean,
well, it gets back to the uniqueness, I suppose, Your Honor. But the point is really what is the purpose of the channeling rule on the federal side? Mm-hmm. It's not to define the scope of habeas. It's to deal with, on the federal side, it's the conflict between the potential for conflict between civil cases and criminal cases, as they both.
Why is there a conflict? I don't understand the conflict.
Well, because of the potential that a civil action could cast doubt on the legitimacy of a criminal.
Why is that a conflict? I mean, the parties will still be the United States and the defendant. And if the defendant wins, the United States will be barred by res judicata when the defendant goes into habeas. So what's the conflict? I don't understand. I understand conflicts between state and federal. I don't see a conflict between the civil and criminal where the case is already over, the judge has sentenced. Well, why is there a conflict?
I'm not quite sure I understand the res judicata point, Your Honor,
if the case is decided in a civil case against the United States, for example, if it were decided in a civil case that this was unconstitutional, this distinction was unconstitutional, right?
Yes.
If it were decided in a Bivens action that the distinction were unconstitutional, that would bind on the criminal side. The person could then come in habeas or could do whatever else that he wanted in order to get a sentence reduced on the criminal
side. But at that point, well, this case is a good example, Your Honor, because if he were to win on the merits here, he would have a purely advisory opinion that would not.
Why would it be advisory?
Because the relief that he's ultimately aiming at, which is, as he has explained in his filings, a 3582 request to reduce his sentence, involves further findings that are discretionary.
That's not an advisory opinion. That's a decision that you can no longer rely on these sentencing guidelines and anything else, and you now have to apply the court's discretion, yes, but that's not advisory.
It does not control whether he would win or lose on the 3582. No. And further, because the district court, either this one or any district court, couldn't order the commission to issue a new amendment, much less a new amendment that treated him more favorably, the absence of the existing amendments doesn't necessarily hurt or help him. It's not clear how that would hurt or help him. It's not at all like the situation where there were where there was a state action that removed good time credits, and if you invalidate that, he's in a better position.
Well, it depends on what the district court's order is. If the district court's order is that you can't distinguish between big dealers and little dealers, you have to give the same benefit to big dealers that you give to little dealers, you can imagine that that would resolve that matter. You can imagine an injunction from a federal district judge to the commission saying you can't enforce this way anymore.
Right, but that sort of a ruling wouldn't necessarily favor him. It could be that they
that's not a question of a conflict. I mean, he doesn't get where he wants to.
Perhaps conflict is not quite the right word. Maybe inconsistency might be a better word. Or perhaps even the
tension.
Tension. What the channeling rule accomplishes on the federal side is allowing the federal criminal system to have the first cut and the deciding cut.
What I don't see is why it matters. So, in our court, the same district judges handle both civil and criminal cases. It's not like we have a civil expert district judge and a criminal expert judge. If this issue were raised in habeas and the district judge were first to hold that it was unconstitutional, just like if a judge in a civil case had done that, that decision wouldn't end the matter. There would be a next step. And I don't see why there's any tension in why it matters whether one judge has to rule first the threshold question and then apply his or her discretion, or whether a judge with a civil case before him or her first decides the first step and then goes back in habeas for the habeas judge to rule. I don't see any tension.
I can see cases where there may be an alignment, Your Honor, but there could also be cases where the standards would be different, where and it would involve incomplete or different rulings that would not ultimately decide anything. Here it is a good example, because if the district court were to find a theory, then there are still many, many, many steps that need to be resolved in his favor for him to win relief. And the channeling rule makes sense to put those decisions in front of a court at the same time.
Even if the channeling rule makes sense, that's a policy judgment. There's nothing in any statute the only statutory thing we've ever heard is the Supreme Court's view about what the core of habeas is. There's nothing else in the statute that says you can't bring Bivens actions. There's nothing in any of the Bivens cases that says they can't be brought. So basically, you're asking for federal common law development here of what would be a better policy.
Well, I think Chapman Bay has already crossed that bridge, Your Honor.
Well, if you think we're bound, that's a different question. But most of the considerations you're talking about now are not mentioned in Chapman Bay.
Well, I think that the access to federal court distinction is the core of the distinction in Chapman Bay, which brings me to my third point about the difference between the two Chapman
rules. There's nothing about this consistency, this conflict issue that's in Chapman Bay, is there? I think as Judge Griffith said, it's an interesting argument, but I don't think we've ever said it before.
Well, it does refer to the federal prisoners already being in federal court to have their federal claims already being heard in federal court.
Right, and that's the federal-state problem, but it's not, and that's why that's different in that respect.
Mm-hmm. Right. Well, that may be, but I think that this case is a good example of why it would be, at a very minimum, be inefficient and create a potential for prisoners to come, particularly to D.C., but even D.C. prisoners, to bring civil actions as a preliminary step to chip away at their criminal convictions, when it certainly makes far more sense to have the criminal standards applied in a way that Congress intended when they enacted both the habeas and the 3582 and the direct appeal mechanisms. Those are statutes that Congress clearly intended to cover those situations. And I think that the same kind of reasoning that the exclusivity on the state side is an interpretation of those statutes, and I think the same sort of interpretive spin applies to the three channels that I've mentioned on the federal criminal side.
What do you say to the government, I mean, to the, sorry, to Georgetown's view of Skinner, that we would hold it has to be in habeas, and the Supreme Court would say it can't be in habeas, and therefore the person's completely out of luck?
Well, I think that's where the 3582 comes in. I think that's the obvious answer to that here. The application of the channeling rule here does not, in my view, imply that
you're asking for something
proper.
Would you have a different rule if this weren't 3582 kind of issue? I mean, if it were any of the other kind of probabilistic issues that we've
I don't think so, Your Honor, because I think that the question is, it's in my view, it's sort of a gray distinction between whether this is almost an exhaustion rule and whether it's a bar. The question is, must you at least start with the criminal remedies that are available before you bring the civil case? That's the nature of the rule, as I understand it, and that's what makes...
3582 weren't available because it's not that kind of case. Skinner suggests, if you put the ruling that you want us to make here together with the suggestion in Skinner, is the person not just channeled but blocked?
I think that's right, Your Honor, and I think that's the history of the crack amendments. I mean, that's...
I'm not talking about the crack amendments.
No, no,
I'm asking for a rule other than
that's why that's a sort of an unpalatable result, I think, is because of the nature of the crack versus powder disparity in it, that it was so severe.
Let me ask it another way. Imagine it's a parole eligibility case, okay? Your position is that can only be brought in habeas, right?
For a federal prisoner?
Yes.
Well, that
isn't that right?
That leads me to the third argument that I made in my brief about we would win under Dotson, right? Is that what you're asking?
Yeah,
about?
Assuming you wouldn't win, I'm sure I can phrase the eligibility way in a way that you would under Dotson, it wouldn't be in habeas, but your view would be that it would be for federal, right? There must be cases like that.
Yes.
Otherwise, your position is Dotson rules both federal and that's not your position, right?
That's right. That's
okay.
Right.
So assume we have a parole eligibility case that doesn't get us to necessarily as required in Dotson, right? You would say that has to be run habeas, right?
Or direct appeal, yes.
Well, it's too late.
Right.
Direct appeal's over, so it has to bring in habeas.
Right.
Is your opponent correct that the implication of Switzer is it can't be brought in habeas, so therefore can't be brought at all? That's really what they're saying to us. I have to say it wasn't quite said as clearly clearly is the wrong way, but I didn't catch that in the briefs, but I'm catching it in oral argument now.
Yes, no, I think that's right. It's fair to say the clarity evolves as we stare at these things longer. I think that's right, Your Honor. I think the court has struggled, this court has struggled with what to do with parole eligibility cases like that. And I think that's right. But I think that the
A person
whether
could, never could not challenge parole eligibility anywhere, in any court at all.
Well, if that's the implication of the scheme, then Congress would be free to amend it. I mean, that's one of the things that...
They're not really arguing for a channeling rule. You're arguing for something much more.
Well, as I said before, I think the channeling rule, it can be read as... it's unclear whether it says to start somewhere or to bar, but in some places it would bar. But the concern about the criminal statute or the criminal channels being exclusive is something that... you know, fuels even the Dotson line of cases. I mean, that's where it comes from, that the notion that do we make this big exception for 1983 cases to cases that would otherwise go to habeas? I don't think that's something that the particulars of your questions having to do with parole can escape from it. I would like to say something briefly about the merits. It is clear that the district court was correct that there could be no relief under Bivens. The dismissal without prejudice means that it would be a fairly futile exercise to vacate and remand with instructions to permit an amended complaint of any kind. He's free to do that.
But you do agree, however, that we haven't used patently insubstantial in these types of cases before, right?
No, as I said in my brief, Your Honor, the factual allegations here are far from frivolous, but the claim is clearly frivolous because of the inability to make an equal protection argument. And the courts have rejected the crack cocaine. I think the best argument he could make would be to rely on the reports that the commission issued when it was thinking about changing. But this court has already held that you shouldn't look at those reports. So there really is no claim that could be made on the merits. And so I think the harmless error rule kicks in, and under the harmless error rule, you would affirm because there's no difference in the substantial rights of affirming and allowing him to amend. But
the government doesn't think it's jurisdictional, is that right?
Well,
or do you think it's jurisdictional?
The
channeling rule.
No,
you don't think it's jurisdictional.
I don't think it's jurisdictional, but that's why I explained in my brief that we think you do have the choice, but we would prefer that you send it back under, or that you affirm under the Rizzoli-Chapman Bay rule, rather than the on the merits.
Further questions? All right. Thank you very much.
Thank you.
Any remaining time for the amicus?
No remaining time.
Right, we'll give you another 2 minutes. You see how lax I am as chief judge. Don't try to take advantage.
He'll change. I'd like to start by addressing the scope of 3582, because Mr. Davis would not be able to raise constitutional arguments under that provision. In fact, it only applies to cases where the sentencing range has been lowered. As an example, Mr. Davis tried to raise a constitutional argument in a 3582 motion based on retroactive applicability of Booker, and the Fifth Circuit affirmed the district court's ruling that such a challenge cannot be brought in 3582. It concluded that the district court correctly determined that a Booker challenge is not cognizable under 3582. On pages 5 and 6 of our opening brief, we cite a number of cases that talk about the limited scope of 3582 and how it is not a resentencing proceeding and is only applicable where the guideline range has been lowered. The government also talks about tension in the federal system, and I think it's important here to take a step back and look at the Dotson opinion itself, because if anything, you would expect that state prisoners would have less and not more access to habeas than federal prisoners, because when state prisoners bring claims under 1983, they are directly bypassing the state habeas system. And in fact, that argument was raised in Dotson, but what the court concluded is that Ohio's door-closing argument was too tenuous to justify looking at anything other than what is and what is not at the core of habeas. For federal prisoners, these comity concerns don't exist, and in fact, the court recognized as much in the case of Williams v. Hill. The only relevant inquiry for the purposes of a Dotson analysis is whether a claim, if successful, would necessarily demonstrate the invalidity of confinement or its duration. Mr. Davis's claim would not do that. In fact, the sentencing court would have the ultimate authority in this case to either accept or reject his 3582 motion, so it would not disturb its ability to act in that space.
You said about the Fifth Circuit under 3582 saying that a Booker claim could not come in that way. But does that extend to all constitutional claims?
Yes, Your Honor. 3582, by its plain terms, only authorizes the sentencing court to become involved in the case when the prisoner has demonstrated that he is subject to a retroactive amendment. Just as the prisoners in Dotson couldn't go.
That's the claim here, isn't it?
Excuse me?
Is that the claim here?
His claim is that he should be allowed to bring the 3582 motion. This is analogous to Dotson in that respect. Just as the prisoners couldn't go to the parole commission because they were ineligible, Mr. Davis can't go directly to the 3582 court.
there needs to be a prior determination that he is eligible, and then he can go to 3582. And that's why there's attenuation in this case, and it's also why Dotson governs.
Prior determination that is as to retroactivity?
There would need to be a determination by the district court that Amendment 750 should apply to individuals such as Mr. Davis who are sentenced for more than 8.4 kilograms, Your Honor.
So we'd have to come completely after a complete judgment on the merits.
Yes, Your Honor, and only then could Mr. Davis bring his 3582 motion, because only then would there be his eligibility under Amendment 750. So that's precisely what the Dotson inquiry looks at. This is just a step along Mr. Davis's ultimate path. And because it is merely a step, success for him would not necessarily demonstrate the invalidity of confinement restoration. In fact, it would have nothing to do with the validity at all whatsoever.
Okay. Hearing no further questions?
I just wondered, I'll stand on it. That's fine.
Thank you.
All right, we'll take the matter under submission. Mr. Goldblatt and Mr. Silverblatt, you were appointed by the court to represent the appellants in this case. The court thanks you for your assistance, which we regard as excellent. Thank you. We also appreciate the work of the government, of course, which is always excellent.